833-800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. American, all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday, the lucky 13th of July, Anno Domini 2000, and lucky 13. And you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And we're going to be bringing you... Oh, that explains why I couldn't hear myself on the mic. I had potted it down. We're going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose. Kick up your shoes. Don't get the blues. Here comes the news. We've heard rumblings of an imminent Microsoft reorganization for some months. On Thursday, it came to pass. CEO Steve Ballmer has announced the company's new shape and its new approach to developing products. The reorganization sees an end to the product-based divisions such as Windows and Windows Live and Microsoft Business Division. What Ballmer wants instead is one strategy, one Microsoft. To do this, the company is being organized by function, Microsoft or some other F word. Microsoft will have four engineering teams, operating system, apps, cloud, and devices, and then a number of company-wide groups for marketing, business development and evangelism, advanced strategy and research, finance, legal, HR, and operations. Ballmer also announced some other personnel changes. Kurt Del Bene, president of Office Division, will be retiring. Craig Mundy, a name we know well, who has been serving as an advisor to Ballmer, will now devote all his time to a, quote, special project. Rick Rashid, formerly chief research officer and head of Microsoft Research, will now move into the OS engineering group to drive core OS innovation. Good luck to you, Rick. In addition to describing the new groups within the company, Ballmer also outlined Microsoft's new way of working. He emphasized five adjectives: nimble, communication, collaborative, decisive, and motivated. Microsoft has already started down this path with Windows 8.1. Major products such as Windows and Office will have teams that span the different engineering groups, so they will draw technology from all these groups. For most of the company, this represents a major organizational and cultural shift, and it won't take place overnight. Ballmer said the reorganization process will take at least until the end of the calendar year. So, our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that's bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, is Microsoft has reorganized. And the choices are, wow, it'll be great. I hope it works. New bottles, same old wine. And here comes another apathy coma, you insensitive clod. So far, we have 32 votes, and here comes another apathy coma. It's in the lead. And I know you'll have more to say about this, so check out the forums. If you go to the forums under Fascinating Stuff in the right-hand column, the second poll the second forum is poll discussion. And the topic, of course, is 13 July 2013. Microsoft has reorganized. So you can place your comments there. And before we go to the phones, let me just take a minute to have a moment of silence. Our friend both my friend and friend of the show, Jack Greenkey, passed away this week very unexpectedly, and I would just like to take a moment. I know it's not something you're supposed to do on radio, no silence on radio. I just want to take a quick moment to remember him. Okay, I don't want to take too long. It's radio. We're not supposed to be silent. Shh, okay. Now we'll go to the phones. Our first caller is Carl, probably from Pottsville, PA. Hi, Carl, what's up? Uh-oh. Carl is gone.
Lost Carl.
Lost Carl. Carl, call back, and we'll be happy to talk to you. In the meantime, we can talk a little more about this reorganization.
Did you see the Joy of Tech article or a comic on it?
No.
They reprinted the memo that apparently went on and on and on and on and on and on.
Yeah.
And at the bottom, everyone was asleep, and they said, sorry about that.
I hope this means some good things in store for Microsoft. One of the Microsoft doesn't make bad products. I've never said they don't make bad products. What they make are bad decisions about those good products. And that's a bit of a problem. And we'll talk more about that after we go back to the phones. You can give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415. Just like Ed did from Ithaca, New York. Welcome, Ed. What's up?
Thank you. I use Yahoo as my primary email. And they switched to some newer version recently, which has a lot of faults. I'm wondering if there's any way of getting back to the older Yahoo.
Sometimes. We hear this, every year or so?
Yeah.
Yahoo updates their interface, and everyone hates it and wants to go back to the old one. Sometimes
a year later is the old one.
Is the old one now?
Yeah.
Sometimes if you look at the top of the screen or hidden somewhere, there's a go back to classic or go back to the old version. But eventually the old version is just gone, and you're forced to use the new version until it changes again.
Because the new version left out a lot of features that the old one had.
Well, that's unusual. Maybe they're just hidden somewhere else that you don't see, because usually don't take away features.
They have two new options. There's basic, and I don't know what the other one's called, but only in basic, not in the fancier one, can you open a message in a tab, in a new tab.
Oh, interesting.
Right-click on it and say open a new tab.
Yeah, but you can't do that in the newer version, only in the basic version. In the fancier version, you cannot do it. In the basic version, you can. There's no place to get to My Yahoo automatically, which there used to be.
My.yahoo.com doesn't work anymore?
Right. Is it? Well, it works, but you can't do it from your Yahoo Mail page. Hello. You used to be able to.
Make it a bookmark.
Yeah, that's all I need to do.
Yeah.
And in the newer version,
there's
lots of problems.
They are intercepting right-click and putting their own contextual menu up, ignoring the OS's contextual menu.
Yeah.
That's annoying.
Yes.
There may be a preference to open in new window instead of open in the same window. That may be hiding under preferences somewhere.
Oh, okay. I can try that.
Yeah, the best thing to do anytime they present you with a new interface is to spend a little time looking at all the possibilities that are available there. You may find that all the stuff you're used to is still there, just in a new place, because God forbid they leave it where you're familiar with it.
Right.
Okay. I'll have to do a lot of searching then.
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
Okay. Well, thanks for your help.
Yep.
Yeah, they call it basic and full featured. Basic used to be the one for dial up. Yeah, full featured just to give you more features. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they always used to say basic was for low bandwidth or dial up users because it didn't try to do so many fancy things.
Right. Right.
But, they're intercepting and ignoring the operating system's contextual menus.
Interesting. Oh, got it. All right, we have Carl back from Pottsville, PA. Welcome, Carl. What's up?
Hey, how you doing today?
Good. Sorry we lost you before.
Yeah, that was my problem. My internet connection went down. I looked at my modem, all the lights went out, and I'm back.
Oh, I'm glad you are.
Question. I have an old computer. It's an old Dell. It's about 12 years old, and it's very slow, and I'm trying to speed it up.
You think?
Instead of replacing it. And I'm just wondering if increasing the memory, because right now it only has about a half a gig of RAM, would speed it up. And when I say speed it up, I'm talking about things like I'll look at the screen. I'm on a screen where there's a password field. I'll look down at the keyboard. I'll type in the password. I'll look back up at the screen. The password field is still blank. And then in about 15 seconds, the password will appear. Or, for example, I have two tabs open on IE8. And I'll click on the X in the upper right-hand corner for a tab to disappear, and it'll take about 30 seconds for the screen to completely get rid of that tab, and it'll slowly go away, like the border will disappear and then other things.
And you've been putting up with this?
RAM will help that.
Mm-hmm. What operating system are you running?
XP Home.
Yeah.
That can go to a gig, can it?
It can go to two.
Two?
Yes.
If the computer can.
If the computer can. One of two things. Max out the RAM that the computer will take, or go to 2 gig, which is, well, okay. You could do 3 gig, but you'll only use 2.5. That will solve many of the problems that you're having. Certainly not all of them, but many of them. Okay, how do I put this? There's two things that cause a system to be slow. One is the amount of RAM you have. The other is the speed of your hard drive. And they're related. The less RAM you have, the more the system depends on the hard drive. For, well, really everything it does. Because it does a lot of swapping. So if you increase... So really, you can either get a much, 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 much faster hard drive, or increase the RAM. And frankly, it's both cheaper and easier and probably more effective to increase the RAM. So go to at least 2 gig. 3 would be the max, and you don't get the advantage of all of that, since somewhere around 2.5 is what XP will handle. But go as far as you can, and that should alleviate some of that, at least. It should also boot faster.
Okay. Now, I was told that since the machine is so old, it might be difficult for me to find RAM, and if I do, it would be very expensive. So what I did was I wrote down as much as I could discover about this RAM. I'm not sure exactly what it all means, but I'd like to read it to you. Maybe you could give me an idea of what kind of RAM I have. I have written down here about the RAM, PC 800, 533 megahertz RAM bus inline memory module. Does that sound like an old RAM?
That sounds like an unusual RAM if it's RAM bus.
Yeah.
That's what it said, yeah.
Did you say this was a Dell brand?
It's a Dell, yes.
You can go to the Dell website and put in your service tag, and that should bring you up the specifications. You can also go to some of the memory vendors like Crucial and Kingston and those. And they often will have a little app that you download that checks what kind of memory you use. But at 800 megahertz, I would have thought that would have been PC2, not PC.
Right.
Well, it says PC 800, but then it also says 533 megahertz.
Yeah, so it's 800 megabits per second at 533 megahertz clock cycle. So most memory has two lines like that. But anything over, I think, was it 300 megahertz was PC2?
That's what
PC?
I thought.
Yeah, I thought so.
But it doesn't matter. What you do is, as Steve said, go to some place like Crucial or Kingston, download their little program, and it will recommend everything it can in terms of speed, size, how much, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, the RAMBUS RDRAM was a standard that didn't catch on. And so it's different than SDRAM. It's RDRAM.
Right, right, right.
Yeah. So you got a pretty unusual machine there.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you.
If this was Auction Hunters, you'd be looking at a lot of money, I'm sure.
Right.
But for us, it's pretty much nothing. I would do that. You could also call a couple of the vendors in town and see what they have. I can't make any promises one way or the other. Not a lot of people may be carrying that. Dell themselves may still have some available.
And as RAM gets older, they don't make as much anymore, so that's why the prices can rise. And because it's odd RAM, they're probably going to rise faster. But, yeah,
okay.
So, yeah, being able to find out exactly what kind of RAM, let me just search at Crucial
so
here.
So at
yeah.
some point, you will be making a decision, which is, you can buy a new laptop for $400. How much are you willing to spend on the RAM?
Right. I have to save some money to do that.
Yeah.
Right, right, right. No, I get that. I believe me when I tell you I get that. But that becomes the choice you have to make. Do you save X number of dollars to keep a 12-year-old computer alive, or do you spend maybe 2X to get a whole brand new computer?
And how long will it take to save? Maybe a brand new computer would be be a better idea.
Yeah.
Well, in the long run, it will be, because let's face it, a 12-year-old computer is a ticking time bomb. What goes next?
Yep.
I'm surprised the hard drives lasted this long.
You see, now don't say that in front of it. That's the equivalent of what else could go wrong.
Yep.
Or it's weird to say that everything will start going wrong.
Right.
Well, another thing to think of maybe is Linux. If you put a lighter OS on it, then the RAM that's in it would run better.
Right. Puppy Linux, damn small Linux, both can live fairly well in half a gig of RAM, but even they like more.
Yeah.
So in the long run, start saving your shekels for a brand new machine.
Okay, guys, I know you got to go, but just one more quick question.
Yeah.
When I bring up the Windows Task Manager and I click on the Performance tab and I look at the page file usage history, how do I interpret that?
You don't.
I don't? Okay, because I thought that had something to do with the hard drive taking over some of the effects of the RAM.
What happens. You have a swap space on your hard drive. When memory fills up, Windows will swap the unused portions of programs that are in memory out to the hard drive so that the active program can run. The fewer programs you run simultaneously, the better off you are, because they do less swapping. And but when you run more programs, there's not enough room in RAM for them, so they have to go to this hard drive. And then they get swapped in and out regularly, and hard drive swaps are very, very slow.
So does this page file usage that I'm looking at right now on the screen under Windows Task Manager have anything to do with that?
The page file manage number does. And the higher that is, the slower your machine is.
It's about 600. It says 600 megabytes.
That's not so bad.
That's what mine is, actually, 650.
Yeah, that's not so bad. But what it means is that for whatever you're running, it's fairly regularly swapping out 650 megabytes of that.
Okay.
And more RAM would help that.
Right. Double the amount of RAM, and you've got another 500 megabytes of RAM, so you will cut that 600 megabytes of disk space down to 100. Right? Not quite, obviously, not quite, but that's close.
Okay, thanks for the advice.
All right, good luck.
Thanks, bye-bye.
Yep. All right, we're going to take a quick break. But we will be back in just a couple of minutes in the longest-running computer show in the known universe. We are Soundbites right here on the truly great and truly member-supported. Don't forget that. That's important. Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And we are Soundbites. As you may have noticed, Steve Ray talked his way back in. Last week I was telling everybody I'd just gotten rid of the two of you. Gone.
Kicked us off.
Kicked you off the air. Steve has talked his way back on, but Dave has not yet. Steve is more silver-tongued and glib than Dave. And so we have Steve back again this week, which means we're also on Ustream. We're also on our Hangout in Google Hangouts. And we're, of course, on the IRC chat. And our next caller is Rick. Rick?
Mark.
Mark, sorry, from Henrietta. Mark, welcome. What's your question?
Hi, folks. Two things. First one is on that Dell RAM bus thing. I get into one of those about a month and a half ago for a cousin. Looked it up. RAM bus is sky high. You could buy a new, brand new Dell desktop for less than a RAM bus to boost up what he's got.
That's what we were worried about.
On speed. I've been listening to some people talking about a new trick with the cheap SSD drives that are around.
Yep.
Take that, stick it in as a second drive, format it, point the swap file to the SSD drive, and just use it for the swap file. Supposedly speeds things up quite a bit.
Yeah, it's also a very expensive use of an SSD drive, but it does work. It's still not as fast as RAM.
A second drive in general will make it faster.
Yeah.
And then, was it Windows Vista that first added? You could use an actual flash drive as your swap file?
Yeah.
But yeah, so and SSD drive is fastest yet. So, the 32, 64 gig SSD drives are getting to be pretty cheap now.
Right.
It's still $1,000 a terabyte.
Right.
Yeah.
But you don't need a terabyte.
You don't need a terabyte, yeah.
Well, you can also, if you get, for example, right,
yep.
if you get a decent-sized micro SD card.
Yeah.
Won't do it on a micro SD card, but we'll do it on a cheap SATA drive.
Oh, maybe. Yep. I've done that since, golly, Windows 3.1. I've used the second drive as my swap drive, and it speeds things up considerably if you remembered what chain to put things on.
And I took your advice on that years ago, and I've been doing it for, 20 years.
Yep.
And it does need to be a physical drive. Some people will partition their hard drive to try it, and that actually slows it down, because then you got to jump between partitions.
Right, but if you have a separate physical drive, that can be useful. Now, he's got I believe he said he had a 12-year-old Dell laptop. So if that's the case, then being able to connect that second drive may not be as easy.
He's stuck.
Yeah, may not be as easy. 12 years old, probably not. But if for anybody else, if you can add a second drive, simply replacing your drive with an SSD card can speed things up considerably. It's one of the things that lets something like a Chromebook or a MacBook boot up in 8 seconds.
And we're seeing,
you have to have enough RAM for the operating system, and the speed of an SSD card results in that 8-second boot up.
And we've also been seeing a lot of the hard drive companies and vendors coming out with what are being called hybrid drives. Apple calls theirs a fusion drive, where it's got like 128 gig SSD along with your 1 terabyte Winchester drive. And so you get the speed of the SSD and the capacity of the Winchester drive at much less cost than that, $1,000 for a terabyte SSD.
Right.
And the OSs are getting smart enough now. I think we just put a Seagate drive in for a customer, and the Seagate controller manages it, but the Mac OS also does too. The files you use the most, it leaves on the SSD. So your operating system files are on the SSD, and then files you open the most are on the SSD part of it. And files you don't use, it automatically puts to the spinning drive. So your computer just seems to get faster and faster.
Right,
as it learns, right. Instead of getting slower, like most computers
right.
do.
In fact, that's the way a lot of systems are working now in the back room. A lot of server farms, particularly virtual servers, are working that way. They have multiple, what they call tiers of drives, SSD cards, 15K RPM drives, 10K RPM drives, 7,500K RPM drives. And the system manages what goes where so that you always get the fastest speed you can. Yeah. That makes sense, Mark. Thanks.
You're welcome. Have a good one.
You too.
Bye-bye.
We've been as Mark said, we've been talking about that since Windows 3.1 rather, and it's a nice feature, particularly if you have a desktop, where it's so much easier to put in a second drive.
Yeah,
and it doesn't have to be a big drive. You want 2.5 times your RAM. So although you can't get a 5 gig drive, let's say you get. Let's say you've got 8 gigs of RAM. You're never going to find a 24-gig drive. You're going to find a 400-gig drive is hard nowadays. So you're still going to get, a terabyte drive. But if it's a hard drive, it's cheap. And you can use most of it as backup for your main drive. If you have a second drive in a machine, you can back up. It's still not the best form of backup, but it's another. It's that belt and suspenders thing. If your main drive goes, you've got all your data on that second drive. But if, God forbid, something happens to the whole machine or your house, you need a third form of backup or a second form of backup, which is a third copy of the data that's off-site somewhere. So that's where things like the off-site storage of Google Drive or Dropbox or any one of those things can come in handy. So, there's a bunch of things you can do for that. All right, don't forget to give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 1-800. 790-0415. I'm going to read another bit of news. U.S. District Judge Denise Cote in Manhattan found compelling evidence, quote unquote, that Apple violated federal antitrust law by playing a, quote, central role in a conspiracy with the publishers to eliminate retail price competition and raise ebook prices.
Oh, my God.
Unbelievable, isn't it? Wednesday's decision could expose Apple to substantial damages. It is a victory for the U.S. Department of Justice, the 33 U.S. states and territories that brought the civil antitrust case, and by the way, all of us who read ebooks. The five publishers previously settled. Apple was accused of conspiring to undercut Amazon.com Inc.'s ebook dominance, causing some ebook prices to rise to $12.99 or $14.99 from the $9.99 that online retailers charged. Amazon once had a 90% market share. Apple chose, the quote here is, Apple chose to join forces with the publisher defendants to raise ebook prices and equip them with the means to do so, Cote said in a 159-page decision. Without Apple's orchestration of this conspiracy, it would not have succeeded as it did. The decision was not a total surprise, as Cote had indicated before the 2.5-week non-jury trial began on June 3rd, that Apple's defenses might fail. This is this result is a victory for millions of consumers who choose to read books electronically, Bill Baer, head of the Justice Department's Antitrust Division, said in a statement. This decision by the court is a critical step in undoing the harm caused by Apple's illegal actions. Baer said Cote's decision, together with earlier settlements, helped consumers by reducing prices of ebooks, and we all want that. Cote said in August 9, hearing to discuss remedies and plans to hold a trial on damages. She also ordered both sides to pursue settlement discussions under the supervision of her colleague, U.S. District Judge Kimba Wood. Amazon now controls about 65% of the ebook market, while Barnes & Noble Inc. has about 20%, and Apple a single-digit percentage, according to Albert Greco, a book industry expert at Fordham University's Business School. In a statement, and this is a shocker too, Apple said it would appeal the decision. So, do you think Apple conspired to fix prices? Give us a call. 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415. And if you read ebooks more significantly than you read, more often than you read books nowadays, paper books, give us a call and explain why. I am now currently reading a paperback book. It's a biography of Terry Nation, the guy who he was a writer in England, among many other things, he created the Daleks and Blake 7 and the Persuaders and a whole bunch of other neat stuff. And I'm reading his autobiography, and I'm reading that as a paperback. But normally, I tend to read my ebook,
yep,
and mainly because I can carry 50 books around in less than the weight and space of one paperback. So, because I read them on my Nexus 7.
Got a new author for you too. We've talked about the Honor Harrington series,
yep,
and the Lost Fleet series.
Yep.
A new guy I've been turned on to was Michael McCollum and the Antares trilogy and the Gibraltar trilogy.
Oh.
What's interesting is the way the different authors describe space in Honor Harrington, it's how many gravities they're pushing. So, and they have inertial dampers. So their fastest ships can do 600 gravities. And heaven forbid the inertial dampers don't fail.
Yeah, right.
But then in the Lost Fleet, they rated everything in terms of percent C. So, you know, so we're going to accelerate to 0.5 C.
Right.
But if we get more than 0.1 C, the closing fleets are going too fast and the relativistic effects make the missiles miss.
The Lost Fleet has some, yep, really seriously real physics in,
yeah,
terms,
well,
of space battles.
Same thing with Michael McCollum. He goes into pretty deep explanation about fold space. That's how they travel from star to star, is gravity lines. But they don't have inertial dampers. So they're pushing two gravities, and it still takes them, you know, a week to cross a system or more. You know, even the fast military ships will only do four gravities because you don't want to kill the people.
Right.
No inertial dampers. Yeah, but it's interesting. The Antares trilogy starts out with the Antares Red Giant going supernova and messing up fold space and cutting off this planet from the rest of the galaxy for 125 years because they're 125 light years from Antares. And it's, so right. It's really interesting that they finally get back into the thick of things and they find there's a war going on, and it's a really, really interesting series. I'm in the middle of book two. It's Steve Gibson from Security Now talks about a lot of these sci-fi books. Don't start the series until the author finishes it.
Yeah.
That way,
which is why I've never read Tale of Fire and Ice.
Yeah.
Song of Fire and Ice, yeah.
So when the trilogy is done, and okay, now there's going to be a second trilogy. I'll wait for those three books to finish before I read them.
Assuming they're a trilogy.
Right. Well, with Honor Harrington.
Douglas Adams wrote a trilogy.
Of six books now.
Six books,
yeah. Honor Harrington's up to 14 books, and there's supposed to be another one coming out later this year. But they've gone off into some side trilogies, too, of other things. Same thing in Lost Fleet. He started telling the story from the other side. It's about two warring sides. And so there's a trilogy of books from the other side's point of view. And it's interesting to see, you know, they're right, too. From their point of view, they're doing everything right.
Well, and that's what actors have always said.
Yeah.
You know, when they play villains, what they say is you don't play a villain. You play somebody who seriously believes that he or she is doing the right thing.
He's the hero of his own story.
Everybody's the hero of their own story. All right, you heroes, we're going to take a quick break. But we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Olden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 40 minutes after the hour, and you continue to listen to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. We are Soundbites, and we are right here on the truly great and truly member-supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 44 minutes after the hour, you're listening to the Greater Radio International Soundbites. And you can give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415. It doesn't get much scarier than this. Blue Box Security claim to have discovered a vulnerability in Android security model that could allow attackers to convert 99% of all applications into Trojan malware. Google says that the hole has been patched and that it has been released to original equipment manufacturers or OEMs. Blue Box Security CTO Jeff Forrestal said that this master key vulnerability has been around at least since the release of Android 1.6 and could affect any Android phone released in the last 4 years or nearly 900 million devices. The security vulnerability is how Android applications are verified and installed. Each application has a cryptographic signature to ensure that the contents of an application have not been tampered with. The security hole, however, enables attackers to change the contents of an application while leaving the signature intact. Gina Scigliano, Google's Android Communications Manager, said that while Google didn't have a statement, she could confirm that a patch has been provided to our partners. Some OEMs like Samsung are already shipping the fix to the Android devices. Thus, Android users will, as they always have, need to rely upon their hardware vendors for this update. They may not need to worry too much, Scigliano added. We have not seen any evidence of exploitation in Google Play or any other app stores via our security scanning tools. Google Play scans for this issue, and Verify Apps provides protection for Android users who download apps to their devices outside of Play. So are you worried about your Android device? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, toll-free 1-800-790-0415. They all have some vulnerabilities in them.
Yep.
At least this one got patched.
And the problem with one of the problems in the Android marketplace, or in the Android market, is that handset makers often put their own stuff on top of Android. And so the Android version your phone is running is usually many versions behind the current version. So it's going to be interesting to see how fast the handset makers update old handsets that they haven't even got up to Android 4 yet. or if they're even going to bother.
Right. Well, so I have an HTC phone, and my HTC phone upgraded last week, I think, so they're on top of it at least. Yep. You would think that if there is a virus vulnerability as big as this one, you would think that all the platforms would and all the makers would probably want to upgrade as quickly as they can to avoid problems that they may have to deal with later.
Yep, yep, absolutely. Absolutely. I do want to point out that in the on the Google Hangout, Joe says from Yahoo's own help pages, for the person who didn't Yahoo's new interface, just use any client you want. So if you wanted to use Thunderbird or Claws or Silfeed or any, you know, any Outlook, Express, whatever you want to use, you can connect to Yahoo's own mail system and do it from there. You don't have to rely on the browser interface.
Right.
And in fact, that's true of most of them. For example, on Gmail, I'm viewing it through Thunderbird right now. I also actually have connected it through Outlook at work. So you can do that either as there are two main ways to connect to any sort of mail system. One is called POP3, Post Office Protocol 3, and the other is IMAP, Internet Mail something protocol, Internet Mail Access Protocol. And IMAP is preferable because what it allows you to do is it leaves the mail on the system, that is to say, on Yahoo servers, but properly marks it read, not read, whatever. So if, for example, you had a client interface on your phone, on your tablet, and on your desktop, and on your laptop.
Which is pretty common these days.
Wherever you went, you would see the same email and properly see the same ones read, not read, whatever, whatever.
So when you read it on one device, it doesn't show up again on the other device if you don't want it to. Yeah.
Right. And so IMAP, and also IMAP, by leaving it on the server, POP3 downloads it to whatever device you're on right now. So if you wanted to, so if you looked at your mail on your desktop and then later on looked at it on your laptop, you would not see the old mail because it had downloaded to the desktop and was only available there. And anything you looked on the laptop would not be available on the desktop anymore. So IMAP is a much preferable way to do things. And as Joe says, the Yahoo Help thing does talk about IMAP. So,
and all the mail services like Yahoo and Gmail support IMAP, and locally here in Rochester, Frontier supports IMAP. Actually, Frontier started using Yahoo as their back end provider.
Right.
So we've been finding it a lot easier on cell phones and computers to tell it you're using Yahoo, and then it sets itself up as IMAP properly.
Right.
Say you're using Yahoo, but then put your Frontier address in.
And that's the other beautiful thing about many of these devices is they come pre-set with certain providers.
Right. So you don't need to know the server addresses that you used to.
Right. So when you go, for example, on an iPad to set up mail, it will say Yahoo, Gmail, Apple, a couple of others. And so,
and then there's an other at the bottom. So we get that question a lot. Well, I use Roadrunner. What should I pick?
Other.
And actually, Roadrunner is the problem here in Rochester. It does not support IMAP.
Right.
So you cannot synchronize your mail between your devices unless the usual recommendation is to forward all your Roadrunner mail to Gmail and use Gmail to sync.
Right. That's what I personally tend to do.
Yep.
I tend to use Gmail a lot simply because I have clients for my phone and everything else from Google.
Yep.
But you can do the same thing with Yahoo and a bunch of others.
And I did remember my Yahoo password this time.
Congratulations.
When you're in Yahoo Mail, when you click on a message, it doesn't open it in a new browser tab, but it does open it in a new Yahoo tab. So you can have multiple messages open in different tabs.
Oh, I see.
But it's a Yahoo tab.
And they're above the blue bar.
And they're above the bar, yeah. But then once it's in that tab, you can make a new tab of mail. So a new browser tab with your mail. So then you can have different messages in different browser tabs. So
okay, that's a little much.
It's a little tricky, yeah. So you make a new Yahoo.
You just use Thunderbird. Use
Thunderbird,
do whatever
yeah.
You want, yeah.
So if you use once you get your Yahoo tab open, then you can make a new browser tab, or browser window. So you can have two windows with your mail in it, or just open a new window and log into Yahoo again in that second window.
Sure.
That's probably easier.
Probably.
Yeah.
But yeah, so there are lots of tricks to getting you into that mail system. But I don't know. It's actually, that's kind of an okay interface. I mean, it obviously is going to take some getting used to. But I like that mail and contacts and whatever that third one is has their own tabs
calendar.
As well. Calendar.
Yep.
There you go. Has their own tabs as well. Very nice. Online calendaring is, I think, underutilized. And part of the problem is nobody has the same calendar, right? So I use my Google Calendar. You use the Apple Calendar.
Most all calendar services can interoperate with the other ones.
But not automatically.
Right. So a family will often set up a family calendar on one service. And it's easiest if you use one service, Google or Apple or Yahoo. And then mom, dad, and the kids can all have their own calendar events. And so dad can see when the one kid has to get to soccer, and mom can see when the other kid has to get to lacrosse. And it can help organize the family.
Yep.
And if something changes on your computer at home, it'll sync to your calendar on your phone.
Right.
And put a reminder on it, so on the way home from work, you have to remember to pick up, Billy at the soccer field.
Right. For the taxi parents,
yeah,
it's a brilliant thing.
As long as the kids don't outnumber the parents. Because then it's tricky. You got three kids and only two parents. We got to figure out something for that third.
Right. Who brings who where, when, what, how? My daughter is finally serious about getting her driver's license. So we went out driving the other day. Get off the roads, everybody, by the way. Just get off the roads now. Don't ever go back on the roads. We drove around for a while the other day, and at the end she turned off the thing, looked at the keys, and said, And I immediately just grabbed them out of her hand because I knew what she was going to say next was, I'm going to need my own set of keys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although she's pretty delayed. I was going to say.
Yeah, well, she's been in college and hasn't needed it.
Yeah.
And was smart enough to say, you know what it costs to put a 16-year-old kid on your driver's license?
Yeah.
16-year-old girl in particular, on your insurance. And now she's of age and about to graduate from college. So she's going into her senior year. So now it makes more sense to do. She's a very level-headed kid. I've been very lucky.
Yeah, my mother would not let me get a driver's license until I was out of high school just for the insurance reasons.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't want to pay those high insurance rates. You're going to wait until you're at least 18, 19 years old before I even let you even decide to license. Because if you're going to get your own license before that, you're not going to be on my insurance because I'm not paying a high premium.
Yep. Make sure you take driver's ed when you're a senior so you can get at least that little bit of discount.
Right.
But I was going to say that you've got one child.
Yeah, so, I've only got the one.
So you don't have that fight between children. But I almost have one child because we waited 15 years between kids.
Right.
So actually, my son's going to be 15, my stepdaughter's going to be 30, and my stepdaughter got engaged this week.
Congratulations. How very exciting is that?
It's pretty good because she's got the wedding already planned.
Excellent.
He hadn't asked yet, but the wedding's already planned.
Yeah.
So I guess there was a picture on her Facebook profile of the ring. He took her up to the Thousand Islands, and she knew something was up because he was acting funny.
Yeah.
And they went to Bolt Castle, and in the midst of all the other weddings in the middle of Bolt Castle, he proposed.
Oh, that's very
that's sweet.
Sweet.
Yep.
That's very, very sweet. We're going to go back to the phones now. We're going to talk to Tim from Webster, New York. Welcome, Tim. What's up?
Yeah, hi guys. I was hoping I could get you to backtrack just a little bit because you went over my head when it came to somehow using Yahoo as, I guess, like a server. I might have misunderstood what you meant.
Well, Yahoo is... Are you talking about mail server or...
That's what I mean. I might have misunderstood what you meant. Because I use Yahoo all the time, but you were talking about setting Yahoo as a default.
Well, yeah, Yahoo is a bunch of different things. It's a news portal for looking at news.
Right.
It's also a mail server and a calendar server. So you can get Yahoo Mail using the Yahoo server. And with mail service, you can use the web page to look at your mail, or you can also use a mail client on your computer to download mail to your computer instead of using the web.
Or better yet, not download it to your computer.
Or it synchronize between the computer and the web, right, with the IMAP mail service.
Okay, that's what I didn't understand then.
We were also talking about using any one of the web services that allows you to store files up there in the cloud as a backup for your files. And,
right.
And you may have conflated the two.
Yeah, I may have. You know, I was I've been finding all these ways around Yahoo Mail for the past year or two to avoid this new format that this past week they finally forced me into. And I get that they want to expose us to advertising. I've even purchased travel stuff through their links before, because I've used their service for over 10 years. But I wish they could have kept that old, and I appreciate the tabs too, but that old format was easy on the eyes.
There is a thing you can do when you're looking at your Yahoo Mail. If you go to the little gear icon in the upper right corner,
yes.
There's a mail options, and you can go back to what they call the basic setting.
Are you sure that doesn't have that same layout, though, that it has? I thought I tried that once, and I still got that same layout with the... is the ad going to be over to the right?
Yeah, the ads are to the right, the mail is in the center, and your mailboxes are on the left. There's no JavaScript involved, so a lot of the menus are different. It's a more basic setting, usually for older computers and slower bandwidth, but it doesn't do all the fancier things that some people may not like.
Okay. It's under mail options, and it's called what?
Basic.
Oh, basic, right. Okay, I remember seeing that. Well, maybe I'll give that a shot then. They've made so many changes lately. Let me ask you this really quick. I was having an issue before with the username popping my password in behind it, because once I didn't drop down to the password field on time, so it would be stuck there in my history drop down, if you know what I'm trying to explain.
Yeah. We have to take a break.
Okay.
But
sure.
I will answer that when we come back. I'm sorry, Tim. We're going to take.
This is the hard break.
This is the hard break. We don't get to screw around with this one. We're going to be back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 59 minutes after the hour. We'll be back with a whole nother hour of Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 4 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. You can give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415. Over 100 fake apps and games have been discovered in the Windows Store, all using popular names to trick users into downloading them. Some are free, but most are priced at $4.99, and others go up to $28.99 in a clear attempt to generate as much revenue from ignorant Windows 8 and Windows RT customers as possible. WinBeta, which first spotted the fake apps, found them by searching for how to use. While this phrase is tacked onto the end of the titles for these apps, it is cut off when actually browsing the store. A closer look at the publishers for these so-called apps shows that they include Green Hot, BA Media, Hot Girl, Facebook Pro, Montian, and Angry Birds Pro. Searching for either of these terms brings up either the how to use or one of these names, brings back even more results of fake submissions. It's possible that the people Microsoft employs for reviewing the apps thought they were tutorials, but that's hardly an excuse for letting them into the Windows Store. Most people can easily see that these submissions are made to trick users into paying for popular apps and games that are otherwise free. These apps aren't just targeting third-party titles. There are even mentions of Microsoft's own Office, OneNote, Publisher, Word, and other such offerings. It's frankly mind-boggling that any of these were accepted into the store, but even more surprising that fake Microsoft apps made it in as well.
You think they'd catch that somewheres?
You think somebody somewhere would say,
oh, look, they're paying, they're charging for software that we offer. Maybe we should look into that a little bit.
Well, you would think.
A lot of it is automated to begin with, because they get thousands of app submissions a minute or something like that. So they the automated tools have to catch something wrong to pass it on to a human. But you would think, if it says Microsoft Office and it's not from Microsoft, then you might want to look at that. Yeah,
calls itself that has Microsoft Office in the title would put a red flag up somewhere. We should check this just for quality assurance. Is it a Microsoft Office add-on? Is it a Microsoft Office tutorial? Is it, you know, we would, I, if I wrote Microsoft Office, I'd want to know that. Microsoft recently announced the Windows Store had surpassed the 100,000 app milestone. Not only is that far behind the competition, and it took the company a very long time to reach that six-digit figure, but apparently at least some of the submissions shouldn't ever have been counted in the first place. A Microsoft spokesrobot had a bunch of blah, blah, blah that I'm not going to insult your intelligence by reading. So our question to you, do you even use the Windows Store? Do you even have a Windows Store app? Give us a call.
No.
585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, toll-free 1-800-790-0415.
The biggest thing we hear from a lot of Windows 8 users is we want to get back to the Windows 7 interface.
Yeah.
And can you get to the App Store from Windows 7, or is it a Windows 8 thing only?
The problem with Microsoft is they cannot let go of the desktop.
Yep.
And yet
the users won't let them.
Well, and they can't. They can't figure out how to do it. The reality is that even Apple has figured out that they need two operating systems.
Right.
One for desktops, one for tablets and phones.
There's some fundamental crossover, but they're different at the on the top. Yeah.
They're different. And so, but Microsoft has not figured that out yet.
In fact, they've been going the opposite direction. They've merged their OSs now. So Windows 8 is the same on tablet and desktop and phone. Even when you don't have a touchscreen desktop, it still really wants a touchscreen.
Yep. And what that means is because, as with most hybrids, it's not viable. I'm sorry, it's just not. It's not a good working relationship. It's not a good...
You're going to find some of the early adopters are going to like it because they're early adopters and they like change and they like new things.
Right.
But the vast majority, especially of corporate clients, who are just now finishing Windows 7 integration, are going to skip Windows 8.
Right.
And the worry, and it's the same worry we have in the Mac platform as we see the iOS look, the Mac OS look more and more like iOS, is come Windows 9, is the desktop metaphor going to be gone completely and you can only do the Metro?
Right. Well, they don't want you to call it Metro.
Right, yeah, and some of that's someone else's trademark. It's the new UI, right? Or modern UI.
Something like
that.
Before we go on to the caller who's holding, please keep holding. We want to get back to Tim's question about the username pops up with the password behind it. Oh, okay. And... you can delete the history. If you delete your there's two kinds of histories. One is the history of the places you've been, and the other is what you've typed into the Windows.
And it depends on what browser you're using as to exactly how you do that.
Right, because I can't get them right to it. But if you delete the saved.
It saved saved usernames or
autofill
usernames, something like that. Yeah, saved passwords.
If you delete those, it means you'll have to start typing them all in again once, but it also means that place where you put your password in after your username will go away.
Or if you're lucky, your browser will let you delete the one wrong one instead of all of them.
Right.
would be nice.
Which would be nice. And in some browsers, you can do that.
Yeah, Safari's autofill, I can do that.
Right. In some of them, you can actually go down the list, left click on it, and say delete. So certainly try that, but it may not work on your browser.
It's really annoying when you misspell your own name because you're typing so fast, and then it remembers that every single time.
Every single time, I know. All right, we have George Greece on the line. Welcome, George. What's up?
I have a question, in keeping with your theme this week of email.
Yes.
Run into a problem here recently where my email arrived duplicate. I think I've had this problem before, but a long time ago, and I don't know of anything I've done intentionally, but the emails come in, they come in doubles.
What mail program are you using to read them?
Microsoft Outlook.
Wow.
We've seen some cases. Normally the way email works is, do you know if you're using POP or IMAP? Okay. When Outlook contacts the mail server, it downloads the messages. So say you have 20 messages waiting.
Yeah.
It downloads those 20 messages and then tells the other end, I've got these messages downloaded. You can go ahead and delete them. If something happens and your Outlook doesn't finish telling the other end that it got them already, the other end doesn't know that. So the next time Outlook goes to look for mail again, the mail server says, oh, you don't have these yet. I'll give them to you. And you can end up getting the same messages again. Do you see a duplicate message in the same event? So when you say check mail, does the same message come in twice at the same time, or does the same message come in again later?
Same event.
Hmm.
I have a practice usually of when I send a certain information or reply to someone to copy myself.
And you get two of those.
Have that record for at least a short period of time. And those have been coming in double as well.
Okay, one of the things that can cause that is if you have in Outlook set up the same account twice or are in fact forwarding from one account to another and then reading both of those accounts. You can mingle mail from multiple accounts into one thing.
So say you have two email addresses. You can have your Outlook pick up mail at both addresses. If you've accidentally told Outlook two accounts with the same address, it's going to get the same mail.
Okay.
So check your account preferences and make sure there's only one account set up.
Okay. I don't knowingly have two accounts and certainly haven't changed anything there in the recent years. However, you may have hit something there on the forwarding, which usually would be from someone else. And when I forward it, I forward it back to them and a copy to me.
There you go. And that would absolutely do it. You will then have two copies of every email, which you don't really need because you've still got the original if you decide to keep it.
Well, no, but I'm talking about two of my forward.
Right.
Right.
So why would I get two of my forward?
Well, if you forward something,
yes,
and you say reply all.
No, I don't usually do that. I'm just replying to one party, and then I send a copy to myself.
In the CC line, for example? Okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Some mail.
I'm going to say that this is not the only situation where it's happening. It's also happening with people who are sending me emails. And those are coming in double.
Right.
Some of them coming in from Amazon or from other corporate identities.
Right.
They're showing up double.
Yeah. Do this. Check. I have seen this happen rarely. But sometimes if you have set up the same account twice on Outlook, this will happen, and you have melded your emails. This will happen. It will all. I have seen it happen. What was the setting? There was a server setting.
Well, I've seen some mail clients have an always BCC myself. So whenever you send a message, you get a copy back.
Right, but that wouldn't explain why he gets two copies.
Yeah,
when someone else sends him an email.
Well, that's okay. It's not obvious to you that there's anything that I've done.
Yeah.
A setting or something.
The other thing I that struck me when you said you sometimes get two messages from companies is you can accidentally get on their mailing list twice. And so that you signed up for Amazon newsletter or something, and then some later time there was another sign up for Amazon newsletter, and so now you're on their mailing list twice.
That could happen, although I'll have to say that it's happening there as well as other situations that are not situated like that, and it's coming through with the same time stamp on it.
All right, so
down to the minute is the same also?
Here are the things that could happen. You could have set up a rule that did it, so check all your rules. For example, a move to folder rule. If you move it back to the same folder, guess what? You get another copy of it.
Okay.
You could have multiple accounts that are all melded together. You could have recreated your profile at some point, and both profiles are active.
Mm-hmm.
It could also be that you're using one of the many synchronization tools, which is screwing up. It could also be your virus scanner is doing it.
Oh.
So there are a bunch of tools to clean up the mess, and what we'll do is we'll put up a link to a page that can explain everything that could have happened and how to go about fixing it.
Okay.
There's also a bug in Outlook 2003 that can cause this to happen, and Microsoft has an update to fix that as well.
Mm.
Right. So Steve will put both of those. excuse me. Steve will put both of those up and first try the bug. If you're using Outlook 2003, first fix the bug and see if that does it, because that's by far the easier of the two solutions.
Okay. Let me just quick. We check here. It is 2003.
Yeah. Then check soundbites.org. Remember, that's bites with a Y. Francis would like us to remind you. Steve will very shortly put up a post with the information for those two things on it. And try the update first and see if that fixes the problem going forward. Obviously, it might not fix the problem backwards, but it will certainly fix up the problem forwards.
Yes.
Then, if that doesn't work in a few days, you know, check it. Let it check for a day or two.
Okay.
Then try the other one.
Thanks for your help.
All righty.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Yeah, Outlook. I'm not a big fan of Outlook. I admit it. I use it. I use it at work because I'm a good little doobie. But and certainly 2010. Is a much better product than 2003 was. There's no question to that.
You'd hope.
You would hope.
There was a 2007 in there too, wasn't there?
Yeah, there were several in there.
I think 2013 is out.
Yeah, 2003, seriously not a good product.
2011 for the Mac. Although Microsoft is trying to push people into their subscription to Office 365 instead of buying physical discs. It's not that bad a deal. You get five licenses for $100 a year, so you can put Office on all your computers at home. That's Mac and Windows. But you just have to realize that that's $100 per year. And if you stop paying, they stop working.
Right.
Most people don't mind paying the $150 for a license once. And then when they get around to it, they'll buy the new version. And that's a problem in Microsoft's mind, is you should buy the new version all the time. And Adobe did the same thing with their Creative Suite, but I'm pretty sure they already have discontinued the physical discs, and you must use their subscription service.
Right, right. Whereas if you're using, at least so far, either Gmail or Google's Docs, or if you want to save things out on the web, or OpenOffice, the OpenOffice suite, if you want to do things on your computer, that's all free.
Yep. But as we were mentioning a little earlier, the Google Apps for Domains used to be free for 100 users, and it was free for 25 users, and it was free for 10 users. Now you have to pay $5 a user.
Right. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. 20 minutes after the hour, Soundbites right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 23 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites, and we have Robert from Rochester, New York on the line. Welcome, Robert. What's up?
Thanks, Nick. Another email question, please.
It's email day. Absolutely. Email day. That's why I'm calling.
It's the most common use of computers, we think, no?
I'm using Outlook Express under XP, and that's really the main reason I'm staying with XP. Otherwise, I would be ready to go to Windows 7. The other thing that's holding me in XP is I've made myself very dependent on their native docking toolbars, which I use like all the time, and I haven't found a satisfactory aftermarket substitute for that. But I digress. You there?
We're yep. there. Go.
Okay. I've been using email probably since 1993, and Gmail probably for 10 years, and I've got a huge archive of messages in Outlook Express, and I've created a very complex directory structure where things are filed in a manner that's to my liking. Now, I'm going to need to migrate when I move to my next operating system from Outlook Express because XP is the end of it.
Right.
Now, I know that IMAP supports a directory structure on the server side. Is that correct?
Yes. But
yes.
My main reason for calling is I'd like you to advise me for a strategy to migrate as easily as possible my existing directory structure on my computer with Outlook Express to my new IMAP.
Well, are you what IMAP pro, do you want to use Gmail?
Yes, I do.
Okay. You can indeed import email from Outlook Express to Gmail. There is a way to do that. What you do is not.
It'll take a very long time because it has to upload all your old mail.
Yeah, it takes forever.
What might be a little easier is to use a different email program like Thunderbird or one of the other ones. And it will import all of your Outlook mail and all your Outlook mailboxes into Thunderbird. And then you can create new IMAP mailboxes on the server. And if you want, you can upload your old mail to the IMAP service at your leisure. One of the problems you may run into if you've had your mail for a long time is even Google only gives you, 11 gigs of mail?
11 gigs of mail.
Yeah, it's increasing all the time, but it's only 11 gigs.
I just priced that out in connection with Google Drives, and they only want like $5 a month for 100 gigs, which would be more yeah. than enough for me. That's a good price point for me. So you're suggesting that I migrate from Outlook Express to Thunderbird and then sync this Thunderbird with like a new Gmail account?
Well, it depends if you want to keep all the mail on your computer or put it all on the server or both.
Well, I kind of want to do both. I realize that the wave of the future is the cloud, but I feel more comfortable having a copy locally as long as I'm technically able to manage that, because you never. I mean, companies do go out of business. You know, yeah. Ashton Tate and Lotus
right.
and,
well,
Kodak
one of them,
and you know this and that. You know, when
yeah.
I go out of business, my problems are over, right?
Well, the nice thing about Google is they have something called the Data Liberation Front. Your data are your data, and you can regularly go into them daily if you want to, weekly, monthly, how whatever works for you. And download every single bit of data that is on Google servers. And a call comes to you as a zip file.
Okay.
So that's kind of nice. But basically, and again, we have we'll put this online. But basically, you know, the email. Let me give you the outline. You basically set up an IMAP account in Outlook Express.
Set up an IMAP account in Outlook Express, yes.
On Gmail.
To the Gmail server.
To the Gmail server, yes.
Right, so that can be a tricky concept. The program you use to look at your mail is independent of the service you use to receive your mail.
I understand.
So you can use any program with any service.
Yeah. Right. So set up an IMAP account on Gmail in Outlook Express. Then...
Stand by. Do you want me to set up a new empty Gmail account?
It doesn't have to be, no. It could be your current Gmail account, and you just add all the folders and mail that you've currently got.
Well, let me make it more complicated. I've got two Gmail accounts.
Yeah.
That both funnel all their messages via POP into a common inbox in Outlook Express.
Okay, really want to stop doing that.
Yeah, change that to IMAP to begin with.
Yeah.
But POP mail has already come down to your computer. You'll have to upload it back to Gmail.
Yeah.
Well, maybe not. Gmail doesn't delete it. Archives. Even with POP, right?
Right.
Yeah.
But let me suggest you do this then.
Yeah.
If you want, start with a clean address.
Yeah.
Import your entire Outlook structure into that.
Yes.
Then re-forward, I guess... forward all of the other two accounts to the third Gmail account.
Yes.
Did that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay. That's probably, considering how complex you've got everything set up to begin with, that's probably the easiest alternative at this point. You can keep telling people your other two addresses, or you can tell them the third address, or you can tell them all three. And you can write all the rules you want to move stuff automatically here and there, back and forth.
Have the older Gmail account auto forward to the new Gmail account.
Right.
Now, I've experimented with IMAP in the past, and I'm somewhat weak on understanding they've got local folders, and it seems like a more complex structure.
Well, the local folder
than I have under Outlook Express.
The local folder is defined by your local email program, so that's mail on your local hard drive,
which most people don't have anymore.
The IMAP folder is folders on the server. So when you create a new folder in your mail program, you have to be sure you tell it on my computer or on the mail server.
So I probably don't want any folders on my computer. I only want them on the server in their IMAP.
Right.
Okay.
And then you can back up to your computer so you have copies.
Yeah.
But if you have mail in two places, now you have a synchronization nightmare. Particularly if you have mail in three places, on the web, on your laptop, on your desktop, and then on your phone and on your tablet, by that point you might as well just give up and become a hermit.
I'm almost there.
Yeah. If you just keep it all on the web and then do the data liberation front backups regularly, then that's probably the sanest thing you can do.
Now, you talked about accessing emails under IMAP from two different devices, and you say you only, if you look at it on device A and then you log in on device B, you don't see it. Does that mean you don't see it at all, or you don't see it new?
That happens in POP 3.
With IMAP, you don't see it as new. So if you read it on one device,
if I'm on the road and I read a message but can't act on it, then I come home and sit down at my desk. That message will be available to me at my desk.
Yes, but it's marked as read.
Yeah, I'm good with that.
Yeah, or you can remark it unread on the road, and it will still be then unread when you get home.
I understand.
And if you delete something on the road that you don't want anymore, it ends up being deleted on your machine at home, too.
Yeah, I understand.
That's the biggest thing we see with a lot of people. They want to delete all the junk on their phone and then don't want to see it again on their computer.
Be careful how you phrase that.
But if you make a mistake, it'll be in your deleted box.
Right.
Yeah.
But you need to be careful how you phrase that, because what's happening here is no mail is actually on your machine. Every machine you have is just a window into the mail that's up on the server, on the Gmail server. So you look at the mail on the road, on your desktop, on your laptop, or on your phone. You look at the mail on your desktop, but you're looking at the same mail. So it's just a window to that mail. So anything you did to that mail on the road will also reflect being done to it when you get home, because you're really looking at the same mail.
Yeah.
Got it?
I think so. This is, somehow I've made my life unnecessarily complicated, but it's worked for me for a long time.
Don't worry, most of us do that.
Yep.
Yeah.
All righty. May I call back a different time and ask about the docking toolbars?
Anytime.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
We all do that. We all make our lives more complex. We spend a lot of time thinking up how to make our lives similar, and by the time we're done, we've made it so baroque, so rococo, yep, that we can't, for the life of us, figure out what we did.
But it works for us, and we don't want it to change.
Right.
Which, you know, people hate change, which is always annoying. When I'm mentioning earlier, when Yahoo changed the way their web mail service looks.
Right. All right, our next caller, Dennis, also from Rochester, New York. Hiya, Dennis, what's up?
Yes.
Is it an email question?
I have a question. I have a pet peeve with a particular website, and I sent their technical support an email, and I didn't get the problem resolved. Every time I go to Home Depot, the Home Depot website, it says, welcome, and lists my zip code as 14621, which it is not, and tells me my store is Irondequoit. And I don't want to shop at Irondequoit. I don't want it to keep listing my zip code as 14621. And tech support said, go into your history, go into your cookies, delete. I deleted everything. I turned off everything, rebooted the computer and the browser, and I go back to Home Depot, and it's still doing the same thing. My assumption is the problem is over there. Am I correct or am I wrong?
It is possible. They will get your information from one of two places. Either a cookie that they have placed on your machine, because at some point you typed in 14621.
I don't...
Or they're pulling your IP address from your provider.
Well, that's what I was wondering. I thought maybe my IP address might be, you know, the server might be located in 14621 or something. I don't know. I don't know enough about that.
Right,
sort of thing.
but that's the other way they do it. They pick that's the less useful way to do it, frankly. It certainly is geekily cool.
Especially with large internet providers where they may have servers all over the world.
Right.
I've run into this with even Rochester DNC. Someone wants their local Penfield News and it keeps coming up, you know, Utica.
Right, right. Because of yeah, that. Now,
well, I happen to use Blue Frog if you guys went, I mean, just because I had it when it was dial up and
right.
And because I wanted to keep the email address the same, I'm actually paying $5 a month or something for it to
sure.
To have email.
No, and that's fine. That's you know, perfectly acceptable. We all talk about free email, but the reality is that a few bucks a month is not a bad thing.
I needed to keep it for lots of reasons, but so is there?
Well, have you? Well, hold on, Dennis. Have you actually typed in your real zip code?
Oh yeah, many times.
Okay.
And as long as I don't close the, well, because I have on my browser, don't remember history, delete cookies, delete everything. That's the way I have it set up. As long as the browser stays open, even if I go to a different page, if I come back, then I'm good. But once I close the browser and go back to that same website, I'm back to where I was again.
Because it's not remembering the cookie, so it's guessing your location based on other service.
Do you have a program, a product, an app, some add-on to your browser that prevents cookies from being set by various places?
I've tried don't accept third-party cookies. I've tried accept third-party cookies. It's Firefox 22.
Version.
Right.
Yeah.
And have you added on anything that might be
no script or ad block or something like that?
I do have ad block.
Let me suggest that for one session, and I've got things to say about AdBlock too, but let me suggest for one session you turn off AdBlock.
Okay.
Go to the Home Depot, put in your real zip code, wander around there for a while, and then you can turn AdBlock back on and see if that fixed it.
Okay, it wouldn't be my antivirus. It wouldn't be Avast that would be doing it, would it?
It shouldn't be. But again, if you're only going to go to Home Depot right away, maybe you could try that too. But I would try AdBlock first.
Okay. I was just looking to see what I have for add-ons, but I guess I'm not going to be. Oh, wait a minute. I can tell you. Avast, AdBlock, Print Edit 9.3, Quick Java. I don't even use Quick Java. I don't even know what the hell.
Generally, you want to turn off Java in your web browser. It's generally not needed on web browsers, and there's a lot of security holes that keep getting found, and Java gets updated every week or so.
There's some videos that when I turn off, a Quick Java is allows you to turn it off manually. I forgot, that's a toolbar at the bottom of the screen. You can turn off Flash and Quick Java with Quick Java. But if I turn it off, there's some things, some videos that I can't watch unless I turn Java back on.
Right.
It's unusual that Java would be video. Flash is often video.
Flash,
yeah.
But could it be any of those things doing this? That also.
It shouldn't be.
But AdBlock Plus seems to be what you think might be my problem.
Yeah, I think that might be your problem.
Okay, I'll give that a shot.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah, I was fighting with that with a customer too this week, where the DNC keeps remembering the wrong town, even though we set it. We go back in, wrong town.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 40 minutes after the hour, and you are listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. So give us a call at Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 94. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 44 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. Hey, we're nothing if not the Segway Kings here. So based on Dennis's call earlier, here's a little news item about AdBlock Plus. If you use AdBlock Plus to keep your web browsing experiences free of annoying clutter, this is the kind of tweet that might grab your attention. Google paid AdBlock Plus to get its ads whitelisted. That was sent by a fellow named Amit Agarwal on July 5th. Millions of people use AdBlock Plus. Per Wikipedia, AdBlock Plus is the single most popular extension of any kind for Firefox. But I'm betting that a hefty percentage of those millions don't realize that major advertisers, including Google, can pay to have some of their ads whitelisted, essentially given a free pass through AdBlock Plus. The so-called acceptable ads feature is turned on by default, meaning that users have to specifically opt out if they don't want to see such ads. There seems to be no doubt that AdBlock is generating some sort of revenue stream from the practice. AdBlock Pro's own frequently asked questions addresses the issues. And I quote, "Do companies pay you for being added to the list? Whitelisting is free for all small websites and blogs. However, managing this list requires significant effort on our side, and this task cannot be completely taken over by volunteers, as it happens with common filter lists. That's why we are being paid by some larger properties that serve non-intrusive advertisements that want to participate in the Acceptable Ads Initiative." Earlier this year, AdBlock Plus co-founder Till Fida said that the initiative was not intended to maximize revenues for large companies, but should be seen as part of an effort to influence the entire advertising ecology in a direction that works for both users and advertisers. So our question to you, have you opted out of acceptable ads in AdBlock Plus? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415. Just like Gary did from Rochester, New York. Welcome, Gary. What's up?
I have a new computer, an i7 Toshiba with Windows 8. I also have two other computers, two laptops. One's got Vista, one's got Windows 7. The Windows 8 computer, about 2 months ago, stopped printing from that computer. My printer is on a desktop with XP. Is there any reason why it can't be supported by Windows 8 or vice versa?
Because Microsoft wants you to buy a new printer?
Well, no, what Microsoft wants you to do, there are a couple of different issues that could be at hand here. Did this stop after an update to Windows 8?
No, Windows 8 was on the computer when I bought it. It worked fine for 5 months.
No, yeah, I'm saying, was there an update?
Did there it happen? Could have been. It was about a month and a half ago.
There are two different ways that Microsoft communicates with other devices, and one is essentially the home way of doing it, and the other is the business way of doing it. They are essentially incompatible. And consequently,
well, there's a third now. You've got work group, home group, and domain.
Oh, right. Yeah. Right. So it may be that the first thing to check is look at your Windows XP system, which probably should be on a work group.
It is.
And it has a name. Make sure that the Windows 8 machine is also on work group and has the same name.
Okay.
And not necessarily on home group, but work group.
Okay.
Right. That's the first thing to check. The second thing to check is if, again, an update maybe, although there are no more updates to Windows XP, but if an update to Windows XP, one of the, you still are getting the essential security updates. If one of those didn't change, make a change to the connectivity of the printer, for example, making it that you have to log in to print to that printer. And so I would check that to see if there's been a change to that, to the way the printer is shared to the network.
Right. Well, the printer, all the other computers work fine. You can print from the Vista computer, from the 7 computer, from the desktop you can. If I take the Windows 8 computer and physically plug it into the printer, it works fine. But once it's unplugged, you do a search for the printer, and it doesn't exist according to the Windows 8.
The easiest solution, I believe, would be to plug the printer into the Windows 7 computer.
Okay.
And share it from there.
And everybody else should see it.
One of the things is to check on is in the Windows 8 machine is check your firewall, make sure it's not blocking file and print sharing.
No, it says everything's on. In fact, I even had the local big box stores come down to the house, and they can't figure it out. They just told me, go buy a wireless printer, and you won't have any problems.
Yeah, of course, because they sell wireless printers.
Right, exactly.
I get it.
You won't have that problem, but you may have a different problem.
Right, like affording the wireless printer. Yeah. But I would... The easiest, if the Windows 7 or Vista machine is a desktop and it's not going to move, I would suggest
those are both laptops.
Okay, that's a separate problem then. The XP machine is essentially a print server. Check to see that in fact something has not changed on the XP machine. It could be an update to your firewall. Because even though you're not getting a lot of updates for Windows, you may get updates for programs that are on the Windows XP system. So your firewall may have blocked Windows 8 because it's not, I don't know why it would do that, but check that. But the first thing to do is make sure that Windows 8 is on the same work group as all the other machines. That's the place I'd start.
Okay. All right, I'll try it.
Okie doke.
All right, thanks.
Yep.
Thanks.
And you can check the fundamental networking architecture. Can the Windows 8 machine get to the internet? Can the Windows XP machine get to the internet? That way the network between them is still working.
The other thing to look at is can the XP machine see the Windows 8 machine in the
network? Right, yep. One of the things we've run into a few times is that a lot of newer routers now have a guest Wi-Fi on it. And if your device happens to connect to the guest network, one of the features of guest is it cannot talk to the private network. It's just to get to the internet for guests in your house. So we've had places where the laptop stopped printing because it switched to the guest network, which can't see the printer.
Yeah.
But if all his things are wired, then that's probably not it.
So right.
But, yeah, I posted a... a tutorial from Microsoft on how to share printers between different OSs, and it still has XP instructions.
Nice. That's rare for something from Microsoft. All right, our next caller is Emily. Is that who this is? From Rochester, New York.
Hi, Nick. It's Emily.
Hi, Emily. How are you?
Hello. Good. How are you?
Peachy. What can I do to make you a happier woman?
Well, I'm calling today because my mom recently bought an iPad.
Uh-huh.
And she loves it. And she uses it and needs to recharge it every day. So she recharged it, but instead of using her Apple charger, she used her Android charger. Doesn't work.
No.
So, a piece of it broke off inside, it looks like to me.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you have any suggestions of how to get that out.
Micro forceps. So she was able to, if you push really, really hard, you can fit the wrong connector in the slot.
Right.
So she was able to fit the micro USB connector into the Lightning slot.
Wow.
Yeah.
Your mom is a strong woman.
Yeah.
If it doesn't fit, push harder. Yeah. We've seen this problem a few times. If you can get a really, really fine pair of tweezers, and a really high magnifying glass to be able to see inside, you can sometimes get the little bits out. But the bigger concern is that you may have damaged the connector.
Right.
And even getting the broken pieces off may not work when you put the real connector back in again.
Okay, I think her big concern was they'll replace it for her and she can pay $250 to replace it.
Right.
But she's going to lose all of her pictures that she has stored on there because she didn't.
Well,
back them up
to iCloud or back them up to your computer.
Well, assuming there's still a charge in the iPad.
Right. That's a good point.
Yeah, I think she has 3% left or something like that. I don't know if it would be enough to get the backup done.
Well, the iCloud backup happens automatically, so it may have already been happening.
It's possible.
Maybe
she doesn't realize it.
Right. Yeah. Have her, if she has a laptop or a desktop, or you can do it from yours, have her sign in and look at her iCloud.
Cloud, storage, yeah,
and see if the pictures are already there.
You won't be able to see the pictures on the web unless you know the address of the picture website.
Right,
it's an annoying thing. There used to be a public interface to your pictures. Now it's private, so you can't actually see them anymore. But what you can do is you can manage your storage settings and see if the storage space is being used for the backups.
Okay, and then if she got a new iPad, then it would be visible.
You'd be able to download it from iCloud, yeah. One thing you might want to try, I'm trying to find our vendor here. You may be able to go to another store, you know, like the one I work at. MacAv in Victor, New York. We're a couple miles past the mall. And some of the third-party stores can repair damage like that cheaper than Apple's out of warranty claim. So since this is considered accidental user abuse, it's not covered by the warranty. So Apple's flat $250 will replace it for you. It may be possible to replace that Lightning connector at a lower charge than Apple.
Okay. Well, that's good to know.
Yeah.
That's what I told her. We may as well try to fix it because it's not going to get any more broken. So let's try to fix it before she goes and gets a new one.
Yeah.
Right.
So if you can get tiny enough tweezers to get the piece out of that little tiny connector, you can try your Lightning cable again to see if it will charge it.
It can't hurt to try.
All right.
Gotta run.
All right.
Gotta run.
Thanks so much.
Thanks. All right. You've wasted 2 hours of your life listening to this show. We're done for another week. Don't go away, though, because George is coming in with the best German music you hear all week. We'll be back next week. I want to thank Steve Ray, Michael Oden. I'm Nick Francesco. We're Soundbites right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1. See you next week.